Hello and welcome to this week's official EFL podcast. It may be an international break, but there's no let up at EFL HQ. Pompey are playing up at the very top of Sky Bet League One. Head coach John Mousinho drops by for a chat.
Even coming up through the tunnel, it's a proper old stadium, and you know when the Fratton End gets going, it's an incredible thing to be part of. And you know, when you're on the receiving end of it, it's not particularly nice. But when you've got that backing, home and away, to be fair, because the away fans, they're brilliant as well. Again, it makes a massive, massive difference.
Back on co-hosting duties is Sky Sports' David Stowell. And continuing our celebration of Black History Month, Watford's Valerian Ismail reveals his true footballing icon. Welcome to the official EFL podcast. So here we are in the midst of another international break, but of course at the official EFL podcast, we just crack right on through. No rest for the wicked. That's not a segue to say hello to my co-host for this week once again, David Stowell. Stowley, how are you?
I'm well, Pretz, thank you. Although yesterday man flu had me in its vice-like grip, but I have risen from my bed and here we are. Podcast was calling after all.
You look very sprightly, my friend, so well done for that. Either that or you were making a meal of it yesterday, but we won't get caught in the reeds
well.
With regards
bit
to that. given the week that we're in, right in the middle of the week, of course, it has been World Mental Health Day, which, of course, has been widely publicised, widely covered. And there was one video that really brought it all home to me, which I saw via X, of course. Norwich City posted a very, very emotive little 2.5 minute video with regards to two supporters sat side by side and the need, of course, to know that you're not alone, to talk, to be able to share the ups and downs and everything in between that comes with not just watching football, but life in general. And we were talking ahead of being on today, weren't we, David, about what that meant to us and what kind of emotions it brought forth. But I thought it was the right time to say well done to Norwich City for such a well put and thoughtful piece. But also, with regards to the day itself, absolutely imperative that it's respected, it's seen, it's acknowledged across the board, isn't it? Because it is. I mean, the hashtag on the back of the Norwich City post was "You are not alone," which is absolutely right, isn't it?
It is, and it was particularly powerful, I think, that obviously using the football setting, you are not alone when you're in a stadium full of thousands and thousands of people. Depending on how high up the pyramid you are, there are still a lot of people around you in a stadium. And they've been particularly mindful, I think, Norwich City over the years, of the need for self-awareness, self-care, if you like, around the sort of mental health side of things, and also male suicide as well, which they featured in a video a year ago. Stephen Fry involved. It was there, not just a kit launch, not just another kit launch, which turned into not a kit launch. It was all about raising awareness of male suicide. And they're very good with that, Norwich City, I think. Recently, funnily enough, Norwich was voted or was labelled the most social media obsessed city in the country, which was an interesting point of view. I don't know exactly how they came up with that title, but the point of drawing that together really is that the club can play a big part in getting to people around the city and explaining situations. And this is a prime example of a video that's gone viral, and understandably so, very powerful and very well done.
Very well done indeed to Norwich City and everyone across the board. As you say, Stowell, it's such a wonderful way of bringing people together, and there's no flippancy in anything that we're talking about here, because there are people across the world obviously genuinely facing a lot of problems and a lot of hardships, and that sense of you not being alone and being able to talk to people and hoping that you're in a position that you can talk to people is one that we echo right here on the official EFL podcast. If there's help that's needed, there's some out there for you. Well, it may be an international break, which means the Championship has a rest, but there is never a dull moment, is there, Stowley? And we know that from working on it firsthand. Birmingham City sat sixth in the Championship, back-to-back wins against Huddersfield and, more importantly, against rivals West Brom last time out. So, of course, John Eustace has been moved on as boss of the Blues, and in comes one of the names of the ages, certainly from a playing point of view, Wayne Rooney, a hefty reputation, of course, precedes him as a player. Managerial experience at Derby County in tricky times, and, of course, more recently, DC United in MLS. Before we get on to Wayne, the moving on of John Eustace seems to me, even in this most harsh of environments, a little too harsh.
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it? I mean, we live in a world of social media where everything is black and white, and I suppose the one thing to say is, although we have sources all over the place within sort of Sky Sports channels and things like that. And we speak to a lot of managers and people. We don't necessarily know all of the details, so it's one that's difficult to kind of explain as well as to get your head around. But yeah, from the outside looking in, it seems a very strange decision. I mean, I covered the Huddersfield victory for Birmingham, in which they were terrific. It was the Siriki Dembele show, if you like, but the whole team was terrific that night. Goals were flowing, confidence was there off the back of a little bit of a stumble in the league. And it just seemed to be all going well again, all smiles again. And obviously the Derby victory against West Brom helped that. And there are echoes of the Gary Rowett situation from years ago. Many people have said that when he was doing well and was let go. And his win percentage, 39.6%, if you like that kind of statistic. The only manager since him who's come close to that is John Eustace, 33.3%. And so it's very strange to think that they've gone through Zola and Redknapp and Carsley, Cotterill, Monk, Clotet, Spooner, Gardner, Karanka and Bowyer to get to Eustace. Then when it's come quite well and they seem to be on the up, off he goes.
The kind of comments coming out of Gary Cook's statement on X along the lines of how good a job John Eustace had done, but moving forward, their ambitions, their goals were becoming increasingly misaligned. Now, I mean, before I absolutely swamp you with corporate speak, I can tell by that glazed look on your face that that's not a direction we want to send this podcast in. So then, sat sixth. As you said, a lot of stuff to deal with both on and off the pitch for John Eustace, not least obviously the state of St Andrews and the rejuvenation that's needed around that particular football stadium. So if I'm looking at this from a very straight angle point of view, if there is such a thing as a straight angle, straight line point of view, what John's done, they're not fans of, but what Wayne does, they are fans of. So what then does Wayne Rooney bring in to Birmingham City that is aligned with the way that they want to go forward?
Well, it's a good question. It's one that I don't necessarily know the answer to, other than the fact that Wayne is obviously, as you've alluded to, a massive name in the game of football, a wonderful player. Let's not do that down, because I think some people have never truly appreciated how good a player he was. And he was an astonishing player, not just for his country, but also for the clubs he played for. And to that end, I think that really helps him in some ways with being a manager, because he's been through a lot of experiences. He's worked under various managers who he's taken sort of bits of personality from. But I also think it hinders him a little bit, because he was up there, and with the greatest of respect to the players he's working with, they're not up there. They're not as good. He will have to temper his expectations in management, as he has done already, obviously, at Derby and at DC United, to sort of expect the championship quality rather than the world-class quality that he brought. And he needs to hit the ground running quickly, because obviously with Birmingham doing pretty well so far this season, if things were to go wrong early doors under Wayne, then it puts a lot of pressure on him and also on the Birmingham City board and the club in general. So it's an intriguing situation which many will watch from afar and from nearby as well, and wonder how it's all going to knit together.
That is the intriguing bit, the biggest challenge, isn't it, for great players? How their greatness informs the way that they, I don't know, teach lesser footballing mortals, because as we've seen, it's kind of meted out to varying degrees of success. And of course, he's got a decent amount of time now, Wayne, to work with the players that he's got. Obviously, the ones that come back from international break will be there in due course. And then he faces a very familiar face in his first game as Birmingham boss, Michael Carrick, of course, the Borough manager, two players that did wonderful things together for both England and Manchester United. I wonder if he's going to be picking the brains of that particular boss, given his experience so far of the Championship.
Well, indeed, and what an experience Michael Carrick has had of the Championship, of course, with what happened last season. And that's happening again this season, isn't it? And to think that they started so poorly in terms of the results that they were picking up, or the points that they weren't picking up, you could say, to then beating Sunderland 4-0, who albeit lost Dan Neil, of course, to a red card. But Sunderland are a terrific side, as they've proved this season and last season. Three goals in 14 minutes doing the damage there. And after 1 point from the first 18 available, they've won 13 from the last 15 available. So it's not a time when you want to be facing Middlesbrough and Michael Carrick, particularly if you're coming in and it's your first game and there's a lot of pressure surrounding your appointment. So, yeah, a fascinating game, that one, to watch.
And of course, off the back of that and what we've discussed, we wish John Eustace all the very, very best. Sneaky suspicion that he will plot up somewhere in the Championship and do very, very well Indeed. The top six is Birmingham in sixth, Leeds in fifth, Sunderland fourth, Preston third, 8 points clear of them in second at Ipswich Town. Leicester City at the very top, 2 points clear of the Tractor Boys, 11 games in across the board. We thought Leicester would do what Leicester are doing. Kudos to them and Enzo Maresca. More on them in just a second. But Ipswich Town, the gift that continually keeps on giving in the Championship. They are absolutely flying, aren't they?
Well, the thing to say about Ipswich, I think, is that when the season started and they were doing very well, a lot of people thought, well, they won't beat the teams who are going to be up there, or they won't get lots of wins together when they're in a really congested period of fixtures. Well, this is where we look at things and say, well, they are beating the teams up there with them. Preston, they beat 4-2 on Saturday. Hull City, 3-0 on Tuesday. They've beaten Blackburn, Southampton, beaten Wolves in the EFL Cup, albeit obviously that's a result that we sort of take away from the Championship side of things, but still an impressive result. So clubs who are up there, they're doing the business against. They've just come out of 7 games in 21 days, I think it is, and they're still doing as well as they are. So I think massive kudos to Kieran. I know Kieran from working with him previously. Very, very talented coach, very level-headed person, and he's talked about creating that buzz around Portman Road again, which had gone missing for a fair few years, and he's certainly done that. People love going there to watch football, and why wouldn't you? So, you know, fair play to them. I think we expected Leicester City to be up there, of course, because of dropping down and the parachute payments and things as well. But I covered Leicester at Tranmere in the EFL Cup, and I spoke to Enzo Maresca afterwards, interviewed him, but also had a good long chat afterwards. And I was really intrigued by his demeanour, by his philosophy, by the way he talked about football. And you can tell he is not getting complacent when he looks at his team sheet and sees the league table. He demands quality, he demands consistency, and that's what they're producing at the moment.
Okay, moving further down, and I mean further down, bottom three, QPR, Rotherham, Sheffield Wednesday. Wednesday still propping up the division, still winless. There's a nice block of time now for these teams to kind of have a bit of a reset, but fundamentally for Wednesday, they need to know where they're going and who it's with, don't they?
They do. I covered them against Sunderland recently, which obviously was a game Sunderland just ran away with, and Sheffield Wednesday had no answer to what Sunderland produced. And yeah, you already look at it and say, right, 11 games in, they're 7 points adrift, Sheffield Wednesday, which is already a fair bit of ground to make up when you've only got 3 points yourself. And their next few games, well, their next three games are intriguing, because obviously they're bottom, 24th. They play Watford away, who are 20th, Plymouth Argyle away, who are 18th, and Rotherham at home, who are 23rd. Now, if in 3 games' time they've got 9 points out of that, then obviously we're looking at a very different league table, and we're saying they're on the up and everything. If they get nothing out of those three, then you start to think, well, where do the points come from with respect to those other teams? And in general, that sort of bottom group, Rotherham's next five include Ipswich at home next, which is obviously tough, Sheffield Wednesday away, Queen's Park Rangers at home, and Watford away as part of that five. And Queen's Park Rangers are at Huddersfield next. So you kind of see now a picture of those bottom teams all fighting against each other, not just looking at each other's results on a Saturday, but actually facing up to each other. And in, you know, what, 4, 5, 6 weeks' time, we'll know an awful lot more, I think, about that bottom three, sort of bottom six, seven in the table, and where it might be heading.
There's the potential, of course, when it comes to the latter stages of the season and going into next season, that a team like Pompey might be climbing above those teams that are dropping out of the Championship, currently sat at the very top of League One. Perennial favourites at this level. The people, the experts, if you like, in inverted commas, look at the size of what that football club is and where it's been and presume it should walk League One. Now, at this moment in time, they're a point ahead. Oxford, though, second with a game in hand and a point behind. And we're going to talk to John Mousinho in due course in this week's pod, which I'm really looking forward to. Safe to say he's doing a good job.
Yes. I mean, he's done a phenomenal job.
That's how
job,
I'm going to start it? When we talk to him. You're doing a good job, John. Thanks for joining us. Bye.
No, it's been incredible, hasn't it? And I think what's impressive about him is not just the results, the points tally, the momentum that they've got, but the squad that he's built there as well. And obviously, we'll talk to him about that as we go along. But you mentioned so many seasons that have been promising and then petered out. The expectation because of the Premier League years, the FA Cup, all of that. And it's very easy, I think, for fans outside of the club to look at the name Portsmouth and think, right, well, you've got to be up there. As you say, you've had success in the past. But it doesn't always work like that. And he's built well from the back to the front. They've only conceded 8 goals in 12 league games this season, 23 unbeaten, 5 straight league wins, 6 wins from 7 in the league. I mean, it's phenomenal. And they've had some tests in that time, not just from the teams who were fighting with them at the top, but also from teams who were in the middle of League One. And I think League One is one of those divisions where teams in the middle can look like they're way off the pace at points, but then they can easily beat anybody. It's a very strange league this season in particular. And it's going to be one that the teams who do go up fully deserve to go up because of the way they'll have played stylistic football, perhaps, but also scrapped to get up into the Championship. And at the moment, you can't really look too far past Portsmouth as being one of those who could be there.
So kudos to them. Even more kudos to Oxford in second under Liam Manning, going great guns. Barnsley, Stevenage, Peterborough, Bolton and Wickham just sat there in second, just a point behind Bolton. Derby in eighth. Looking further down, I got a little text off Max Rushton, no less, talking about the Burton-Cambridge game, saying he was thoroughly enjoying the comms. Who was the comms? It was David Stowell. A little ripple of applause for everyone from an international celebrity. Well done, my friend. Further down we look. Cheltenham, of course. I've got a mountain to climb, but step forward, Rob Street, the man that broke that biggest of ducks. I don't know what you'd call a giant duck. I don't know. But the fact that it took so long, of course, to get themselves on the score sheet. Two interesting stories coming out of Cheltenham Town. Yes, Rob Street scoring that first goal in 12 league games. Curtis Davis called up to Sierra Leone at the age of 33.
Yes, remarkable that. And good on him. Good on him. May he enjoy the experience and be terrific in the shirt as well. We know Curtis, of course, from the years in the EFL and the Premier League as well, but also with the bit of media work that he's done. And that's a nice little story, that, and hopefully you can go and enjoy that. In terms of the goal, I mean, 11 League One games without finding the back of the net. They were just desperate for someone to either step up with a moment of absolute wondrous quality or just a deflection in off someone's backside. Anything would do at that point. And to get that goal is key. And also, that goal brought them a very good, solid point against Derby County. So you kind of see that game as not just, right, we've got the goal at last, but actually we got a point that maybe in our position we didn't expect to get. So let's kick on from here. And, you know, international breaks come at the worst time for some clubs, don't they? And for them, they'll just want to keep focusing on the games rather than watching international sides on the TV. And they'll want to get stuck into their next one, even though their goal difference is still minus 19. So a lot of work to do, 8 points adrift from safety. So, you know, they won't get carried away, but at the same time, they'll want to build on that.
Baby steps, as you say. And as you mentioned as well, the international break is there, of course, for the Premier League, which we don't talk about, and the Championship, which we do talk about quite a bit, which means that centre stage on Saturday lunchtime, you've got Notts County, the very top of League Two, against fifth place Mansfield. And Mansfield, my word, still unbeaten, the only team in all four divisions that can say that. The last time these two played at Meadow Lane, Nottingham Forest won 4-0. That was in the 91-92 season. And Nigel Clough was in the red shirt of Forest that day. He, of course, is in charge of this wonderful Stag side. And given where they are, that's the dogs chipping in as well, enjoying what Nigel Clough has done so far with Mansfield Town. I mean, given the job that Luke Williams has done, given how high and free scoring Notts County are, given, with the greatest respect, the lack of football around and about, we could have a big crowd watching a high-scoring game of real quality in League Two on Saturday lunchtime, couldn't we?
Absolutely. I think the dogs just heard you say stags and thought they might run off and chase something. In terms of the crowd, I mean, they're expecting nearly 19,000, I think. And when you consider that this is a League Two game, then that's a remarkable crowd. It's an impressive crowd anyway. But it shows you the power of Notts County in the area now that they're back in the EFL and obviously looking to kick on and do things properly in the division, and then hopefully from their point of view further up. And yeah, it's a really good battle between two intriguing sides. Mansfield Town coming so close on so many occasions recently. The playoff final a couple of years back against Port Vale was obviously a game littered with emotion from a Port Vale side of things, with Daryl Clark and what happened to him and his family. And in the end, Port Vale just sort of steamrolled Mansfield. The red card didn't help in the final. But John Radford's been very vocal about the fact that he wanted to back Nigel Clough and he wants promotion. You know, so many near misses. He wants to go up, and he wants to go up automatically. So this is the kind of game, if they're targeting that, then realistically, they need to go there and show that they are that good and can be that good in this division this season, which clearly so far they have been, and Notts County will look to the likes of Macaulay Longstaff and David McGoldrick, who've done so well for them in front of goal, and the solid defence as well that they've started to build.
Okay, that's the Championship Leagues 1 and 2 done and dusted. There was, of course, a busy midweek in the EFL Trophy, not least for Portsmouth, who put 5 past Gillingham. Pompey absolutely flying at the very top of League 1. We're going to talk to their boss, John Mussino, in just a second. I'm going to let David Stowell have a break as well, because to celebrate Black History Month, Watford's Valerian Ismaël is here with his football icon.
Hi, I am Valerian Ismaël. This is my football icon. My first memory of Basil Boli was early in the 90s. I think it was the season 1991, when I remember it was a big time for Olympique de Marseille. Marseille played the final against Red Star Belgrade, dominated the game. So everyone was sure that Marseille would win the cup. And actually, when you watch the game back, it was no doubt. But this is the beauty of football. So the Marseille lost the final. It was a heartbreaker. And I think, especially from that time, Basil Boli at the end was crying all the tears of his body. Really, it was touching, it was moving. When you watch back the situation, and I think it was very significant for everyone, because he become the face, a sad situation. But how it is in football, 2 years later, Marseille is back in final against AC Milan. And as football story wrote in, that Basil Boli scored the winning goal. And after the game, you saw him straight away to the fan, and he showed his face with this time no tears. And I think it was a great moment from him and from the French football. And at the end, 3 days later, Marseille played the big game against Paris Saint-Germain, and Basil Boli scored another goal, unbelievable header, a diving header from the edge of the box. I think this period of time, Basil Boli was really the face from that time, Marseille, and for us, we were young defender. He inspired us not to never give up, and even to continue to believe in your dream, to keep fighting even when you fail, but stand up and go again. And I think it was the big story behind Basil Boli. We learn from him. Great player, very aggressive player, great mentality, defender, and that's why I pick Basil Boli. If I saw him today, I would say thank you. Thank you for the memories. Thank you for giving me the path of believing that it's a way for everyone. Football is for everyone. Just believe in yourself, keep dreaming, even after a big setback or defeat. It's everything possible, you just need to believe in yourself.
Okay, big thank you to Watford's Valerian Ismaël there. And we'll be celebrating Black History Month again next week and throughout the month of October. And speaking of celebrating, given the fact that they are top of the league and off the back of a very convincing win last night in the EFL Trophy, Pompey boss John Mussino joins us. John, how are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Very well. Yeah, just checking in after the EFL Trophy game last night with the lads this morning. No game this weekend, so it's nice to have a little break.
So hang on, right, they've won last night, they've scored a lot of goals, they're in the very next day. I mean, I know a lot of the modern day footballer is a tough one, but any days off at all, boss, come on.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, this is a rare one. So we're usually off every day after a game because you've got no game this weekend. We're in this morning, just do the wrap up of the game. A couple of lads need to train and then we're off until Monday. So they have got some time off.
Done and dusted like that. And yeah. I suppose the nice portion of the season that we're in now with you getting a little break is you look at where you are, you look at what you've done. You sat top. We were chatting earlier on in the pod, myself and David, talking about how well things are going. And from the outside looking in, you could say very well indeed.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really good start for us. Probably a bit better than we expected. We sort of aimed at the end of the sort of 12-game block at the start of the season to be in and around the top six to make sure we just had enough points so that we could, we could challenge and sort of change our fortunes from where we were last year, where we finished eighth and we thought we were about the eighth best team in the league. Mm-hmm. And yeah, everything's gone pretty well, especially in September. We had a really tough month of fixtures in September, and we came away with quite a few points. We won all of the games except for one away at Derby. Really, really positive. And I think that the international breaks come at a good time for us. Even though we've been winning games, it's nice to have a little break and then just, I think more than anything, just to take the mental strain off the boys.
What sort of, I've been impressed with, John, particularly not just obviously the results, the progress that you've had, but I covered the game against Exeter at Fratton Park and watched the squad, a very balanced squad, it feels, from the outside looking in, the way that you've got experience, but you've got youth. You obviously brought in people like Regan Poole in the summer. You've got Marlon Pack in the midfield area, and then you've got Colby up top scoring the goals and various other players, obviously, in between all of that. Is that a squad that you look at and you're particularly pleased with how you've built it?
Yeah, I mean, it's been building for a while now. I say a while. When I first came in January, at the end of the transfer window in January, we knew almost exactly where we'd be in the summer in terms of the outgoings and what positions we needed to fill. So it made the summer a bit more straightforward than, I say the normal, it's my first ever summer that I've had recruiting. The recruitment department here with Rich Hughes as the director of football, it made things a bit more straightforward, I think, than possibly other transfer windows. And, we had the chance really to bring in 14 players, which was great. We knew what profiles of players we wanted to bring in. And we thought we had a fairly good mix of players in the building as well, the likes of Marlon and Colby. Two players have got a huge amount of experience. So I think it just gave us a bit of scope to bring in some younger players as well without that experience. But we still put sides out that sometimes feel young, but we've actually got quite a lot of 26, 27, 28-year-olds who have played quite a few league games. They know exactly what they're doing at this level and they're real developing leaders as well. So we are really pleased with the balance of the squad. And one of the things that's been, I think, evidence of that as well is the fact that the cup games have gone really well for us when we've made 10, 11 changes a lot of the times as well. We only made six last night, but managed to come away with a 5-1 win. But, the whole squad are competing and that's really important for us.
Just give us a sense of, because I've only ever been to Portsmouth and Fratton Park as an away player, and being a former Southampton player, my word, you do know that you're in a battle, and the welcome that you get is unique. But it's a very proud city. It's a city that has seen a lot of success from its football club. It's the kind of fervent adulation that you want, I presume, if you are a manager, a head coach, if you are a player, you want that huge kind of passion from the fan base. What do you feel and see on a daily basis and around match days?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I'd committed to when I joined the club was to move down here. So I've moved down here with the family, and I think you just get a better sense of what the club means to the people in the city. And it's a bit of a cliche, but there's plenty of people down here who live for Saturday afternoons, and that's the way it should be. I was like that as a fan, as a kid as well. So the football club means a huge lot to the city. There's the Navy, the University and the football club. And, Portsmouth as a football club are definitely number one in the ranking there, I think. And, it's also, like you said, you alluded to there, the club in recent history have gone through some pretty tough times. And, the fans who have been used to Premier League football and European football have now had to go through the mill a bit with what they've sort of witnessed with the club going into administration and then coming back through the leagues. And with that, there's a huge amount of expectation, a huge amount of pressure. But when it goes the right way, I think you get all the rewards. And we've seen that over the past few weeks, especially when the fan base get going, when they can see the the progress on the pitch, then you get just a massive backing. And I was like you, Prats, I'd only ever come to Fratton Park as an away player. And I knew it was just a horrible, horrible place to come.
I didn't want to say that.
Yeah, that's one of the things.
But you're right.
I said, look, it's awful to come there as an away player.
Intimidating, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, let's keep that up. Let's keep that up. Even coming up through the tunnel, it's a proper old stadium. And, when the Fratton end gets going, it's an incredible thing to be part of. And, when you're on the receiving end of it, it's not particularly nice. But when you've got that backing, home and away, to be fair, because the away fans, they're brilliant as well. Again, it makes a massive, massive difference.
Do you feel a bit of responsibility when you take a job like this because of the history, because of the way the fans are, the atmosphere at the place? Because I suppose fans, when they have a new manager come in, some will be sceptical, thinking, well, you know, he's coming down here, he's taking a job, he's earning the money, and he'll go away at some point and we'll still be here whether the team's good or not. And yet a club like this, with its history and its personality, if you like, there must be a responsibility that comes with that.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, David, my introduction to the club was slightly different, because the pressure I faced coming in was, I guess the questions raised when I came in was, who the hell's this guy? Which was fine. It was a really fair question to raise. I think people.
I get that all the time in commentary. Yeah.
And we wanted to address that, and we wanted to sort of demonstrate that the appointment was made for a reason. And so I felt a massive amount of responsibility, first of all, to the club, because I thought, you know, it's a really bold and brave appointment in terms of what they were willing to do. Taking someone, I was a registered player at the time, so taking somebody from the same league as a registered player who'd never managed a game of professional football in my life, to take that responsibility and sort of, you know, put me into the driving seat at Portsmouth. First of all, I thought, you know, I do feel the pressure there to deliver for the football club in terms of the structure. And then very, very quickly, you realise that, you know, like you say, the fans will be here for forever. They'll be here for a lot longer than me. And then it's just about, you know, me trying to do everything I possibly can to put Portsmouth in a better place. So yeah, massive amount of responsibility. A lot of it is cliched, but when you actually get into the role, you realise it's all true for a reason. You know, we're just stewards at the football club. People put their hard-earned money into it, and they, you know, they live and die for football. So yeah, all of those things combined, I think, make it a very, very highly pressurised job. But that's what I enjoy about it as well. I really enjoy that responsibility and the fact that there is something on every single decision I make.
You mentioned that word responsibility, John, and given how you've got to this kind of juncture in your career, working, of course, with Carl Robinson as a play coach at Oxford, then working within the PFA within the chairman of the Players Board. I mean, that's not necessarily the most straight of lines and one that's well trodden, is it, by former players that go into management? How has that helped you? And is, as I said, you use that term responsibility. Is that something that you've sought out throughout your career? Because, I mean, if I cast my mind a very, very long way back when I was besmirching a football pitch that you were on at the same time, looking way classier and more in control of a football than I ever did. There was that sense of a player that did enjoy being in charge of players, of being responsible for players, of being a leader. Has that carried you through via Oxford, via the PFA, into that chair right now at Pompey?
Yeah, I think so. And I always enjoyed taking the leadership role, whether I was a captain or not. I think the first time I was made club captain, I was 26. Prior to that, I felt like at times, you know, I just enjoyed the responsibility, and I never felt my age really on the pitch. And a big part of it was, you're probably being, you know, too kind on my career there. A big part of it for me was the fact that I tried to make up for some limited ability sometimes with leadership skills and organisation. You know, particularly when I moved from the middle of the park into the back four, I thought, well, I can just organise everything from here, and it made my life a lot easier letting other people do my work. So I have always enjoyed it. One of the funny things about being on the football pitch is, you know, you're one of 11 people, and you have to rely on those other 10 and everybody else behind you to actually enhance your career and do everything possible to, I suppose, make you better. And part of that is trying to influence them. Part of that's trying to make them better as well. And so there's a lot of things, I think, that ran through my career that really helped me to make that transition into coaching. And then, you know, to take those two separate sort of points, Carl gave me a huge boost in terms of my introduction into the coaching side. I was a player. I was a registered player at Oxford, and he gave me a huge insight into the daily workings of recruitment, coaching, team selection, dealing with different departments, all of those things, and gave me a massive amount of responsibility as well. So by the time I took this job, I'd seen firsthand what it was like. I hadn't made the decisions, but I'd certainly seen firsthand. And then, yeah, on the other end of the scale, taking the role as chair at the PFA, it was, you know, there's a lot of similarities, I think, in terms of leading teams and again, managing people. Half the job, I think, is managing people. And I've got 11 players that really like me every weekend, and I've got 15 that hate me, and that's absolutely fine. I get that. It's about making sure.
Just to clarify, that's the 15 that aren't playing. If you're listening to this, it's not just 15 people that walk around Portsmouth hating John Messina.
No, and I get that, and they don't. To be fair, we've got a really good squad, but I've probably better way to put it is we've got 15 people that aren't happy, and I don't want them to be happy. And that's perfect. I don't want players in the squad that are satisfied not starting. And it's been really difficult this season as well, in particular, because we've performed really well. So we've got really, really good experienced players that aren't getting a game. And yet, you know, the reason I allude to that is because it is about managing people and how you sort of bring everyone together to try and work towards a collective goal. It's really difficult. I'd say the tactical side of it, you know, anyone can argue the toss on that, and we can all have a good go on it. I do think that, yeah, managing people is one of the most important things.
We know you, John, as this sort of well-spoken person in front of the camera and on the radio when you're doing interviews and things like that. But I just wonder if you could take us into the dressing room, onto the training pitch, and sort of explain what kind of a manager you are, because you've worked with some real characters, haven't you, as a player? You know, Graham Westley, Gary Rowett, Carl Robinson, you've mentioned, Nigel Clough have been your managers through your career. So what are you like compared to them, and how do you treat the guys who you're managing?
Yeah, really good question. Martin Allen was another one. I had
Simon. My God, I mean, you've been through the ringer there, John, with all of those.
I mean, Martin gave me my first pro contract. I still speak to him. I spoke to him in the summer. I've taken bits from all of them. And I think sort of tactically and in terms of the exposure to the game, Carl gave me, everything I thought I needed, or as much as I possibly could as a senior pro in the last 2 years. And then all the others, I've taken bits from all of them. I think I had 17 or 18 through my career. I don't know if that reflects particularly well on me, but 17 or 18 managers. And they've all got brilliant traits. And in my opinion, they all had flaws, which I tried to avoid. And I'll obviously have mine as well. So I think my style, I've probably got a bit of everything there. What I've really tried to maintain, and I thought was my biggest advantage and biggest disadvantage coming into the role. So in my opinion, my biggest disadvantage was I'd never done the job before. And then my biggest advantage was I was literally walking from the changing room into the role of head coach. So I'd been sat with those players. That's it. I played in the league last year. I know how difficult it is. I know what it's like being a player trying to raise a young family. I know it's not straightforward. I know that when you're given instructions, sometimes it's difficult to carry them out. I think I know what I liked about training, what I liked about analysis, how long I wanted to be in meeting rooms, all of these sort of things. So in terms of style, I just try to... without pandering to players too much, but we've got a great group, I think, who, you know, it never comes into it. Really just try and focus on them, get them happy, get players happy, make sure they understand what we want them to do, make sure everything we do in training is relatable to what we want to do in games. I'm I guess a combination of probably all of those guys. I've got a bit of old school in me, I think, but certainly with plenty of what we've seen recently with the sort of young and up-and-coming managers.
What's just jumped into my head there is I was remember chatting to Alex Neil a long time ago about him coming from being a player into being a manager, and he was saying the very first time or the first few times where you go from being one of a group of men sat looking at one man who's talking away and you're there looking out the window scratching your backside and looking around to being the other person at the end of that, you're now looking back at dozens of eyes that are all looking at you for the answers, and you've got to be succinct, you've got to make that good first impression, you've got to not lose sight of what made you a good teammate, but you have inevitably, and you would have seen this in your career, John, that man that stepped over, he's gone through the looking glass, he's not one of us anymore, and no matter what players think and feel and how you make them think, there will be an element of that where, oh, is the gaffer, is the coach now. How have you found that transition? It sounds like you really enjoyed it and embraced it, but have you noticed perhaps players that there is that element of kind of, it's that wariness of the boss, isn't it? We've all got it.
Yeah, I mean, I had my first week in the job, we had Fleetwood away on the Tuesday, 3 days into the job, and 10 days earlier I'd travelled and I was in the squad for Oxford as a player at Fleetwood away, and I travelled on the bus. I didn't mind messing about with the lads. I was probably at the back of the bus playing cards. And all of a sudden, I'm sat on the front of the bus thinking, you know what, as a player, I don't want the head coach and the manager anywhere near us at the back. So I sat to myself. I kept myself to myself. Come and make an impact when I think I should in the change room or in meetings. And it is, yeah, it's really different. And I do sometimes joke with some of the lads, more one-on-one of some of the senior boys. So in a different world, we'd have been playing together and we'd have been mates and we'd have been, you know, having a laugh and taking the mickey out of the head coach. And it is just very different. And the biggest thing the players, I think, want is they want somebody that, in my opinion, they can relate to and knows what they're going through. But they don't want a friend or they don't want a mate. They want someone who's friendly, but they want someone who is also their leader and actually gives them a bit of clarity on the way that that we want things to develop as a football club. So yeah, that wariness exists. I tried to break it down to a certain extent, but also I do think there's a lot of merit in having that. I think a lot of the time in these situations, players do want a little bit of separation. I leave the dressing room completely to Marlon and the senior pros, and they do a brilliant job of running it. And it's a really interesting transition, but it has been enjoyable. I've enjoyed the, I guess that word again, I've enjoyed the responsibility of taking everything on this side.
It's like on this podcast style, isn't it? The real fear that you fear for me when I'm running things, and with that real kind of stick that I've got, not the carrot, making sure your questions are spot on. And
absolutely. I was actually going to ask John one other thing about the empathy that you've got towards players, because you've recently just been one, but also the fact that you've played in a lot of different positions in your career. So you talked about midfield, and you talked about going into the back, but you've also played in goal, haven't you? I mean, albeit briefly. Yes. But for that 75 minutes or so, was it 17 years ago, something like that, for Brentford. So do you sort of have the empathy around the field from the different positions because of where you've been in your career?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was one of the... I used to joke with the lads at Oxford towards the back of my career that I'd played every position in the league apart from left back, actually. and that included playing in golf. But really, goalkeeping is really easy, by the way.
It's not a player, is it? For a start, the gloves are sticky. Just catch it and moan.
It was great. I mean, even looking at goalkeeping is a brilliant example. I went in goal in the League One against Gillingham, and I would watch the play unfold in front of me. And all of a sudden, I think, I've got no idea where I am on the pitch. And I look back and I think, oh, the goal's like 10 yards away from where I thought it was. And then the ball comes at you really quickly. And I just thought, oh, this is a tough position. So I think hopefully the understanding of different positions has led me to, first of all, tactically understand the game a bit more. I wouldn't sort of purport to be able to tell centre forwards what sort of runs they need to make or how to hold the ball up. But certainly middle of the park, full-back positions, centre half, I got a lot of experience there. And yeah, having played every position, even knowing the physical demands of the game in different spots, I think has really helped. It just means that at least I do have a conversation with a lot of lads. I can relate to what they're actually trying to achieve.
And like you say, I mean, you seem way too balance switched on normal to be anywhere near a proper goalkeeper anyway, John. I think that is what jumps out of this podcast. There was a funny story about when Stephen Bywater, ex-West Ham goalkeeper, made his debut. I think he let in five goals in a 5-4-5-3 thriller. He's watching a replay of one of the goals that's gone in as the ball's gone whistling over his head because someone's seen from the kickoff that the goalkeeper stood up to part looking at the screen trying to work out where he was on the particular pitch. He nearly caught him off guard. Therefore, goalkeepers, we know what they're like. They're a bit crackers.
Yeah, I used to run with Stevie as well, so I know he's
so you know exactly what... I've done it as well. I mean, and look, we're both here and we've lived to tell the tale. I mean, that is a different podcast entirely, what Stephen Bywater gets to.
Live to tell the tale is the way to describe it, I would say.
So we've worked out that you're finally going to give the players a couple of days off. What's this weekend then? Is it a trip to Whiteley, bit of shopping down that neck of the woods?
I think actually there's a couple of games that we're looking to go to on the Saturday. It's a rare opportunity. Usually we don't get a chance to see games on a Saturday, so it's quite nice to go and get a couple of league games in. And then the biggest thing I'll have to try and do it myself. I'll really try and persuade the staff, especially, to actually take some time off. Because of that sort of mental toil that I think it takes, that constant grind of Saturday, Tuesdays. And I need to be better at it myself, but I probably won't. I'll probably just ignore my own advice. I do quite enjoy it and I do love the job. So, yeah, I think what we want to do is just come back refreshed, really, on Monday. And, it's a big part of it for us. And obviously, we want the players to put the feet up. And these lads these days are all very, very professional prats. They don't have any worries there.
Well, from that point of view, that's reassuring to hear. And speaking of professional, as I'm sure you would have experienced on this podcast, David Stowell, some wonderful questions, Stowell. I really enjoyed that, my friend, once again.
Every now and again, I come up with one or two.
No, really good, mate. Really, really good. And John, I want to thank you very much for your time. It's a real privilege to get former players and managers on like yourself to come up and give us chapter and verse. And it's been wonderful to see it unfurl. A lot of my extended family are all Southampton fans. So they're getting on with their own mission at this moment in time. But Pompey would be a welcome addition back towards the Championship come the end of the season. We wish you all the very, very best, my friend.
Cheers, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So then, that's another episode done. My word, these weeks are flying by. A big thank you to John Musinio, David Stowell and Valerian Ishmael. As always, if you've enjoyed it, then please do give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share on all of your socials. If you're listening to the audio-only version of this podcast and haven't as yet seen us in full glorious Technicolor, my word, you are missing out, then you can watch this on YouTube. All the episodes are on the EFL's YouTube channel right now, including this one. So go and give us a gander if you haven't done so already. My name is David Prutter. Thanks for tuning in. And I'll see you same time next week for another episode of the official EFL podcast.